The administration in Washington is committed to putting up walls. The New York State Assembly is committed to breaking them down.
Welcome back to Hyphenated America, where we make immigration laws and policies easier to understand. I'm Sophia.
And I'm Maria. This week, we'll be introducing a new series on the podcast, Hyphenated Cities, where we delve into the ways national and local immigration policies have impacted immigrant populations in a different city and speak to local leaders on the topic. We are kicking off Hyphenated Cities by focusing on New York City, where Sophia and I both attend college together.
Later on in the episode, we spoke to New York State Assemblywoman Carmen De La Rosa, who is currently running for City Council in District 10.
So we can start off by getting some background on demographics to understand why and how certain legislation is pushed in a state. Nearly a quarter of New York residents are immigrants, while almost one-fifth of the residents are native-born U.S. citizens with at least one immigrant parent. The top countries of origin for immigrants are the Dominican Republic, China, Mexico, Jamaica, and India.
Over 500,000 U.S. citizens in New York live with at least one family member who is undocumented, and the state is home to over 28,000 DACA recipients. Last year, the New York State DREAM Act was enacted, which created the New York DREAM Fund Commission and amends eligibility requirements and conditions governing certain awards. So what this means, it actually doesn't create a path to citizenship, and there are some eligibility requirements of it. One of the most important being that a recipient must have attended an approved New York State high school for two or more years, graduated from an approved New York State high school, and applied for attendance to New York State College or University within 5 years of receiving their New York State high school diploma.
It's also really important to mention that New York City is also a sanctuary city. There are a lot of different and confusing definitions for this, but one that Sophia and I really liked came from America's Voice, and this is their definition for it. A sanctuary city is a city or a county or state that limits its cooperation with federal immigration enforcement agents in order to protect low-priority immigrants from deportation while still turning over those who have committed a serious crime. According to reporting from the New York Times, despite its sanctuary city status, ICE still deports nearly 3,000 immigrants annually in New York City. Later on in the episode with Carmen, she speaks about this specific issue and how we need to reimagine and reconstruct our immigration and criminal justice system at large in order to find solutions that don't separate families via detention or deportation.
After this short break, we'll speak to Carmen De La Rosa, the Assemblywoman for the 72nd District of the New York State Assembly, which includes portions of Hamilton Heights, Harlem, Inwood, in Washington Heights in Manhattan. She's currently running for City Council in District 10.
We're really excited to have Carmen De La Rosa, a New York Assemblywoman, join us today. Carmen, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd love to talk about your background and how you got started in your community-facing work. So my first question is, how did your upbringing as a Dominican American from Upper Manhattan influence your interest in politics?
Well, thank you. I was born in the Dominican Republic and I immigrated here to the Inwood section of Washington Heights when I was a baby. And Inwood was kind of the first community that my parents knew, that I knew. We came here because there were more Dominicans, which is the story of so many immigrants across the nation, where we come and we build communities, literally. My mom was a home attendant. My dad owned a grocery store just across the bridge in the Bronx. And, you know, as a young child, Spanish was my native language. Learning and assimilating to kind of having English be something that was a privilege to know really got me started in what many of us have experienced to be our first delve into activism. Because, you know, I was the translator in the building. I was a translator in the family. I was the one that accompanied my neighbors to appointments in order to get access to benefits, government benefits that were much needed. And so I feel like that upbringing really shaped my perception of what it meant to serve a community. And then later on in my teenage years, my parents were really strict Catholics. They only allowed me to go to youth group on Fridays, which was sort of my outing into the world. And I really got to know some really cool, dope young people from our community that were kind of struggling with the same things I was. And that really solidified for me the need to always help and serve. Later on, I had the privilege of being the first person in my immediate family to go to college. And I was debating what I would major in. I really loved history. I'm a history buff. I love reading. And, you know, history for me was where I wanted to be. But I decided that it was boring. I got bored of the lecture halls. And I decided that I wanted to do politics and learn about campaigning. Because for me, politics and political science is like history on fire. You could like talk about changing some of the lessons that we learned throughout history. So I decided to go into poli-sci and focus really on the prevention of world hunger with a concentration on peace and justice studies. And that really for me was a moment of clarity into what I wanted to do going forward. I thought that I wanted to go to law school. So I did the whole take the LSAT, wait and see what the results were, see what the possibility was to get into some of the law schools I wanted to get into. And during that time, I was worried about paying student loans, which is an issue that all of us have confronted or are confronting in the moment. And I've never really been without a job. To be honest with you, I always worked 2 and 3 jobs while I was in college. So when I decided to go to law school, I interviewed at a law firm and then I interviewed at an assembly member's office on the Upper West Side. And when I entered the assembly member's office, it was buzzing with people. The walls were colorful. People were in there talking English, Spanish, everything you could think of. And I kind of felt home. So I took that job as a scheduler for Daniel Donald, who's the current assembly member on the Upper West Side. Which is ironic because he's now my colleague in the assembly. He was my first boss right out of college. And so for me, that began what it is my career in government, working with elected officials to uplift the struggles of our families. I was in government for 10 years before I decided to actually run. And when I decided to run, I was facing an uphill battle. There was an incumbent that had been in the seat, not only in this seat, but had been the council member, had been the commissioner of immigrant rights in the city of New York, was the first Dominican elected to office nationwide. And I chose to run for the seat because I felt there was a void in leadership. Like, I didn't feel seen by the government officials that were around. Not only were there no women, but there was also no one that had represented my generation in uptown politics. And so I took the leap, and against all the polls, we swept and we were able to be elected to be the second woman to hold the position of assembly member in the 72nd district.
That's an amazing full circle moment, you know, starting off translating for your parents and then ending up being a colleague to your first boss.
I'd like to move on to talk a little bit about the New York Dream Act, which passed last January and aims to provide tuition relief for undocumented students applying to college. So what challenges did you face when advocating for this policy with your colleagues? And how would you like to expand on this in future legislation?
Well, it was one of those bills, one of those moments where the work to try and get this bill passed began way before I was elected to office. The bill was introduced in the state assembly years before I had made it there. And I give all credit to the young people, the dreamers, who really were the force behind ensuring that not only on the national level, there was a movement built to tell their stories and to fix this inherent inequality in our education system, but they were fearless in coming up to Albany and making the coalitions to bring this issue to the forefront. So when I got there, the person who had held the bill for previous years before I got there had just left the assembly. He was running for the city council, and the speaker of the assembly knew that education is something that I'm so passionate about and immigration. So bringing together those two interests, I was able to introduce the legislation. It was a challenge because a lot of the narratives, you know, New York State, because we're New York City centric, we tend to forget that New York State is very diverse in its beliefs and in treatment of immigrants. And so I remember when I first introduced the bill and we got so much hate mail, so much tweets about how we were taking away from many to give to the few. And that is so opposite of what I believe this bill does. I think this bill is a leveling point that brings everyone to a point in their lives where they can say higher education is an option. And if you're someone that has followed sort of what's happened in this country with student loan debt, you know that it is not only unjust, but morally bankrupt to say to an immigrant child who was brought to this country, like many of us, that they're not able to pursue their careers. So it was definitely a challenge, but it was, I think, aside from the birth of my child, it was the best day in my life to see the Dream Act pass on the floor of the assembly and then see what followed. New Jersey passed the Dream Act. We were able to get driver's licenses for all in New York. And we continue to push to bring justice to immigrant communities across the state.
I totally agree with you. And as far as like the activism on the ground from dreamers who kind of put their destiny in their own hands is always really inspiring. Before I ask about sanctuary cities, I'd love to follow up about this activism. How do you think the undocumented community that you serve can kind of like help lead further and like future legislation that would help this community? I know a big thing is like wanting to include undocumented communities in like COVID relief because, you know, because of their undocumented status, they can't get it. What are other things for the undocumented community you'd like to see passed, especially in this extraordinary time?
Well, absolutely. I mean, first of all, one of the things that I will tell you that I have experienced from immigrants communities throughout is this solidarity that exists between us. That community that I spoke about, I think, is the saving grace for immigrants across this nation. Whether you're documented, whether you're not, whether you're someone who comes from a mixed status family, having the support systems that exist for these families is what kept families afloat. So during COVID, for example, we saw how mutual aid was something that was a lifeline for so many who otherwise would have gone hungry. Getting involved, having your voice be part of the decisions that are being made in favor of your community. When I think about the state assembly, for example, I think about the leaders that have been elected, especially this last cycle, the cycle before, we're overwhelmingly electing women, immigrant women, women of color, women who have family members who have been directly impacted by the immigration system in our country. And those voices and those narratives are so important to have at the decision-making table. Whether you're someone who's documented and can vote or undocumented and cannot vote, there is still a space for you in every process and in every decision that is made for our communities. So that is always a message that I leave to our community, that no matter what your immigration status is, if you're an immigrant, if you're someone who has a stake in your community, get involved. Make sure that you're uplifting some of the organic and grassroots work that is being done, because it certainly is happening, whether you know about it or not. And make sure that you bring your narrative. I tell young dreamers that I've met with that, you know, people will try to put you in a corner, but no one can buy or take away your experience. Good or bad, if you've been through this process, if you've been through the process of trying to become a citizen in this country or be documented in this country or be a student in this country, that's a valuable experience that no one can really take away. And we have to make sure that we're elevating those narratives so that we can begin to problem solve for our communities.
I agree. They definitely have so much wealth in their experience and know the legal system more than I'm sure, you know, some lawyers and, you know, theorists do. And that's very valuable. So now, you know, asking similarly, how do we can protect the undocumented community through sanctuary city policies? We know that New York has been a sanctuary city since 2017, and that that particular status has been under attack by agencies like ICE and the Republican Party. There are still thousands of arrests and deportations by ICE in New York City every year. What do you think the limits to sanctuary city policy is, and how do you think it can be improved to further protect this community?
Well, first, let's start off with the positive note that in a few days, we won't have to deal with the orange man at the White House who made it his mission to try and punish cities like New York who tried to really implement a sanctuary city policy. But that doesn't mean that we need to go to sleep now or stop the work, right? Because Joe Biden and Harris administration also have to be held accountable, right? We know that as good of a president as Obama was for some things, there were still a lot of deportations that were happening. Granted, maybe not in the inhumane ways that we came to learn about under the Trump administration. So everyone needs to be held accountable, from our local leaders, the mayor, the city council, to our state leaders, the governor, the legislature, to our presidents and his commissioners, his cabinet, the vice president. Everyone needs to be held accountable so that our communities can actually have a voice in these processes. I think that one of the things that New York City has tried to do well is that it has tried to incorporate benefits for undocumented New Yorkers. They've really made a point about ensuring that, for example, ICE was out of Rikers, that legal representation for people who were facing deportation was given to families who may need it. But there were limitations. For example, if you were someone who was convicted of a crime, you were not granted access to legal services. I have a pretty radical view when it comes to the intersectionality of criminal justice and immigration, justice and immigration policy, because I really am someone who believes in zero deportations. For some people, they're like, what does that mean? That means that even if you committed a crime, if you served your time, you should not be deported. Why? Because I believe that at the crux of immigration is the fact that as superpower, the United States, plays a critical role in destabilizing third world countries, countries that are torn by war and violence, and sending people back to their death does no good for the person that is sitting right here in our own country that maybe we could help transform. So I have a very radical view that maybe some of you share on criminal justice and deportation. So I believe in the full abolishment of ICE. I believe that needs to happen. I believe that on the state level, we have an inherent right to protect immigrants, grant them access to the benefits that all New Yorkers have. During this pandemic, one of the bills that I worked on that I introduced with a coalition of advocates was the Excluded Workers Fund bill. Because, you know, many people had no help from government, not in the form of unemployment, not in the form of a federal stimulus check. And many of those people were frontline workers. When we were all quarantined in our house, if you called and you made a delivery for food, that person that brought your food most likely was an undocumented worker. And those people had no choice. They could not stay home. And many of them perished during COVID. And because of that, you know, I believe that we should be creating laws and programs that take into account what they've given to our city. I think that one of the things that this city could do better is ensure that as we look at police reform, that the issues of immigrant New Yorkers is brought to the forefront. Most recently, I stood at a press conference where a constituent of mine was picked up at his place of employment by ICE, who pretended to be local law enforcement. That's actually against state law, but we also need federal law in order to ensure that that doesn't continue to happen. And so there are still areas where we need to continue to expand and work.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd love to go and dive in a little bit more about the Fund Excluded Workers movement that you brought up. So the devastating impact that COVID-19 has had on Black and Brown New Yorkers. And I was really moved by some of the statistics introduced by the page that 90% of immigrant Black and Brown New Yorkers reported job and income loss, while only 5% have received unemployment insurance. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about what particular stories from members of your community are you hearing in regards to this impact?
Yeah, there are so many stories. And to be honest with you, they're heartbreaking. They're stories of people who lost the main breadwinners in their families, people who have been either unemployed or lost their job because the restaurant they worked at or the clothing store they worked at was closed. They didn't have the option of remote work. There's also stories of people who, for example, their husband was the main breadwinner or their wife was the main breadwinner. And with remote learning and everything else that's going on, they can't go back to work. So these are families who have been completely left out and shut out. And when we started talking about this bill, one of the impetus for it was, for me at least, was that the governor of California had created a fund to help immigrant families try and get some funding. And the fund was so small that I knew that it wasn't going to have a big impact, but at least he was doing something. And I was sitting at home in my frustration and I was like, why hasn't Governor Cuomo put together a fund for immigrant New Yorkers? And so I began the conversation with organizations like Make the Road New York and other advocacy orgs. And we began to think about our own way of funding the needs of immigrant workers, undocumented workers, workers who are members of the non-traditional workforce, like sex workers. How are we adding to their ability to recover from COVID? And working with Senator Jessica Ramos from Queens, we came up with this idea that we could be raising revenue for New York State, which right now has a very large budget deficit, by raising revenue and taxing multi-billionaires. In New York, we have about 118 multi-billionaires that during the pandemic have increased their wealth. Could you imagine, while we're closing stores, while we're closing restaurants, while people are at a historic unemployment, 1.4 million New Yorkers applied for unemployment benefits at the height of the pandemic. There are 118 people that are making billions of dollars. And you know what? I bet they don't even live full time in New York City. And so that there was an inequity there. There is a moral wrong there. And what we said was that if those people gave a little bit more in the form of a mark-to-market tax, which would be on a tax on capital gains for goods that they have, that have actually increased in wealth during this time, they would have a tax on that wealth, and that wealth would then generate for New York State about $23 $1 billion. With that money, we would create a new type of unemployment for excluded workers, but also it gives us leeway for funding other needs in our state, like remote learning, like housing relief, right? And all of those basic needs that in our communities that were so disproportionately targeted, we didn't have to begin with, right? If the housing crisis wasn't so dire in the communities of Washington Heights, less of my neighbors would have passed due to COVID. So we're still working to try to bring those solutions to the forefront. We're having a lot of trouble. You know, there are a lot of people in the state that do not want to tax their millionaire and billionaire friends. But we're applying pressure, grassroots pressure, to ensure that that they're able to give a little more in order to make the lives of so many that much better.
I really liked how you put together the dire need of all these communities and how it's all interconnected with criminal justice reform, economic relief, and really the severity of how Black and Brown communities have been impacted. Love to talk about your city council race. So you're running to represent District 10. Tell me more about your district, what you're excited about with this race, the specific needs of this community. You definitely have talked about it in such a brilliant and beautiful way, but would love to hear more about this district and how you're excited to serve it.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. I made the decision. It was a tough decision, but I made the tough decision to run for city council a few months ago in July. And, you know, I am a sitting assemblywoman, right? So the question that I often get asked is like, why do you want to run for city council? And the reason that I want to run for city council is because I think that there's too much at stake to sit it out. In the state, I focus, my lens is statewide. But as a mother, as an immigrant, as a woman of color, I know that what's happening in the radius around where I live, where my child goes to school, where we work, where we play, the impact of what happens in those areas comes from City Hall, comes from who's at the head of this city, the mayor, the city council. You know, the role of the city council is to be a check and balance on what's happening with the mayor. If you all at all paid a little attention to what was happening during the budget fight this past year, you saw that one of the major things that came to the forefront was the police and how we're funding police and law enforcement and city agencies. The reason that's happening is because it's known that the city will be confronting a major financial crisis. And in my view, this budget and all future budgets cannot continue to be balanced on the backs of working class people of color who live in communities like mine, who have a stake in communities like mine and have no one to speak up for them. So I'm looking forward to coming down to back home, down to New York City, to make sure that we have a voice at the table, a voice like mine that is a booming voice in favor of our people. I consider myself to be someone who has always listened to the needs of our people. When the time comes to hold people in power accountable, I've done that. And so I'm looking forward to doing that for the district. The districts are the same districts I kind of represent in the city council. They're a little expanded. It's the communities of Washington Heights, Inwood, Marble Hill, and Hudson Heights. So there is a little bit of an extension into the Cabrini, Fort Washington area of the district. It's a diverse district. It's a district that is made up of people of color, but also, you know, the district is changing. Gentrification has taken hold. It's something that I look forward to putting a stopgap to. We need to be able to have ownership in our communities, talk about the housing situation. This community also went through a major rezoning under the de Blasio administration and with the current councilman. We need to make sure that there are investments that are coming into our community without like bleeding out the people who have built this community. And so I'm looking forward to being that voice and earning the support of my constituents to continue to bring that energy and that spitfire desire to protect them to the city hall.
So finally, we wanted to ask, how do you think your candidacy will impact the future of the New York political scene? And how do you hope to have an impact on our greater understanding of immigration policy?
Full circle, once again, you know, I began talking about the impact that immigrant Black women of color have had on the political scene in recent years. And I think that we can't discount the work that has been done by young women, by young people in our communities. And I identify as both a young person. I'm 34. I'm getting old now, but I'm still one of the youngest legislators in office. And I'm also a woman, a young mother. So I think that how I will impact the political scene is that I try to bring, like, I'm myself in every room that I walk into. And I'm unapologetic about my people and our needs. And so what I think I'll do in that council is, one, be someone who will bring that voice and that fight, but also someone who knows how to build coalitions and be able to say, you know what? We need to work together in order to move things forward. I know exactly how to do that. I've been doing it in the last 4 years in the assembly. And I'm looking forward to continuing to do it in the city council. So it's going to be a journey. The campaign, the primary is June 22nd. And so, you know, I'm looking forward to working with young people like Luis and others to, you know, build an army that will help us to bring to the forefront the needs of our community and the voices of those who feel like they've been marginalized and not taken into account with politics. It's what drew me into this fight to begin with. Is why I took the risk of running for office as a young person. Like, I remember walking down the street and handing people a flyer with my face on it, and people would say, are you even old enough to vote? And then getting elected and having other members say, I have suits older than you. But I felt that it was important to have my voice, my face, my advocacy, so that other people could look and say, you know what, I'm capable of that and so much more. Like, I'm so committed. All right, I'm one of the first, but I can't be the last, right? We got to hold that door open and make sure all of y'all come in after us so that we could have a transformative change in the way that politics and government happens in New York City.
I definitely think that the people closest to the problems are those closest to the solution. That definitely seems to like guide your work as far as, you know, bringing justice to Black and brown communities. And thank you for all your work and for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. And again, you know, for the listeners, follow us on social media, Carmen for NYC. Become part of the campaign because it's important, not only just for this campaign, but for our city to have the voices and the narratives of young people, students, immigrants, women, men, gender nonconforming folks to be part of this race. And not only of this race, but of what is happening in our city. And I appreciate the opportunity.
Special thanks to New York Assemblywoman Carmen de la Rosa for speaking to us. Be sure to follow her on Instagram and Twitter at Cien de la Rosa and her campaign's Instagram and Twitter at Carmen for NYC to get information on her campaign and how to get involved and support.
Be sure to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and our Facebook page to stay up to date with the podcast. Also, be sure to check out our website, hyphenatedamerica.org, where you can access our guides, weekly breakdown of immigration news, and so much more.